Welcome to the Mountain Grapevine program on WART Community Radio for Madison County, North Carolina. My name is Chuck Blethyn, your host for today's program. The Mountain Grapevine reports on all things grape and wine in the mountains of western North Carolina, and sometimes elsewhere. My programs will have interviews with movers and shakers in the viticulture and wine industries, as well as some educational sessions on wine etiquette, wine evaluation, and special value-added products that can be made from grapes.
On today's edition of the Mountain Grapevine radio show, I'd like to discuss a few things about winemaking. Just recently, here at the Joel Ridge Vineyard Mountain Grape School, we had a class in winemaking, which brought back some memories that I probably should share with some folks about winemaking. Whether you're a newbie or somebody who's been at it for a while, you always run into these kinds of problems. I'll call this segment today my troubleshooting for winemaking, or what the heck happened. I'm going to be discussing a number of items. First is alcohol fermentation, when it gets stuck or sluggish. If your malolactic fermentation gets stuck or sluggish, the wine color is too light, your wine is turning brown, it smells like vinegar or nail polish, sometimes it may smell like sulfur. So we'll go into each one of these processes today and talk about the possible causes or remedial actions you could take to prevent it. We'll cover these one by one as we get started. The first one is really about alcohol fermentation not working the way it's supposed to. When you pitch your yeast in, you expect to see some bubbling going on. You expect to see and smell some wonderful smells of yeast that's happening, but once in a while it doesn't. If you see that it's not really working out the way that you think it should with respect to the fermentation activity, you may want to take some actions to see if you can get it fixed. Sometimes you have to accept the fact that the potential alcohol levels beyond the yeast alcohol tolerance. It turns out that most times if you ferment wine, you pitch a yeast in and it'll get up to about 14.5, maybe even 15% alcohol, and then suddenly the fermentation will stop, even though there may be some excess sugar existing in your wine. And this is because the yeast is not tolerant to high concentrations of alcohol. Some winemakers like to add a little water and dilute the must down to the desired Brix or the specific gravity. And that's not the best thing to be doing. If you're doing that, you're also diluting the aromas and flavors. Also, keep in mind that if your water has a bleaching effect, that is, beyond the dilution on reds, it may contain something like chlorine in the water and so forth. So you want to be very careful about this dilution idea. If the fermentation is produced by 15 to 16% alcohol and stuck, the alcohol content has exceeded the yeast capacity. It'll be very difficult restarting fermentation with that much alcohol in it. It would be best to leave the wine as it is and look for ways to balance it with blending with a lower alcohol wine or increasing acidity or something like that to make it more palatable. Another common cause of a stuck fermentation is too cold or fermentation temperature when you're actually fermenting your wine. All you have to do is increase the temperature of the room, put it in a place where it's a little bit warmer. Typically, about 64 to 72 degrees Fahrenheit is the ideal temperature. And stir it around to distribute the temperature evenly and get the yeast back into suspension. If you conclude that the fermentation is stuck because of high sulfur dioxide from excessive sulfite additions, try aerating it, that is, racking it from one carboy to another, or doing a pump over to try to reduce the free sulfur dioxide. In most cases, when all conditions of the must or wine are normal, an addition of fresh yeast supplementation with nutrients should restart your fermentation. There are some preventive measures that you can take to prevent this problem from occurring. One is, before crushing, sort and remove any moldy or rotten grapes. The microorganisms that live in those rotten grapes could deprive your yeast of much needed nutrients. During crushing, you can add sulfites to the must to achieve between 25 to 50 milligrams per liter. Sulfite on the low side of the range if grapes are in excellent condition or if you intend to carry out malolactic fermentation, MLF. Sulfite on the high side, there should be considerable grape damage, or if there are signs of rot, if you don't intend to put the wine through MLF. Before inoculating with yeast, make any adjustments to the must chemistry, including temperature, so as to be compatible with the selected yeast strain. When preparing the yeast starter, make sure you allow the culture yeast to hydrate to the recommended duration, usually about 10 or 15 minutes, with a warm temperature of water, about, say, 104 to 109 or Fahrenheit. And fermentation should start within 24 to 36 hours. Sprinkling dried yeast on the surface of the must is a practice that we've learned to use here that seems to work out a little bit better and has less chance of the fermentation getting stuck. So when you inoculate it, just gently stir it into, introduce the oxygen, stir it once or twice daily to promote a good healthy fermentation. Supplement the yeast with yeast nutrients, especially if you suspect some deficiency, because some grapes have considerable mold. You must also benefit from a lysozyme treatment when dealing with affected grapes, and always replenish more yeast nutrients at about one-third sugar depletion. So our next problem we're going to take a look at is malolactic fermentation, or MLF. Now, some folks may not know what malolactic fermentation is, but I can tell you it's something that you do not want to experience after you put your wine in a bottle. I've been woke up in the middle of the night before with sounds of popping going on down in my wine cellar, and it turns out that malolactic fermentation was not intended, but it took place anyway in the bottle and blew the corks out or exploded the bottle. So something you want to pay close attention to if you're going to go through MLF. Malolactic fermentation is normally applied to wines so it tends to soften it up, reduce some of the sharp feel on the palate of some of the acids that are in there. Lactic acid bacteria, that's the kind employed in MLF, usually comes in a small vial in liquid form. You add it to your wine batch when you're making wine. This tends to cause the malolactic fermentation to kick off. And basically what it's doing is converting malic acid into lactic acid. Malic is a very sharp acid, and lactic acid is somewhat smoother. Sometimes you'll find some wonderful made Chardonnays that have been gone through malolactic fermentation, and it just really makes it much nicer and smoother, richer taste to the wine. In any case, this is something you want to add in as an intentional thing. Leave some adequate time for it to work. And if the MLF is stuck because of high SO2 from excessive sulfite additions, you can try aerating it by racking the wine back and forth or doing a pump over again to reduce the free sulfur dioxide until it's within the strain specifications. You'll need to prepare and re-inoculate with fresh malolactic fermentation bacteria. If your wine's pH is too low, most MLF require a pH of at least 3.2. Deacidify the wine until the pH is in the range of 3.1 to 3.6, ideally. You may need to prepare and re-inoculate with fresh MLB if that's the case, too. If the alcohol content has exceeded the MLB content, there's not much you can do to complete a stuck MLF. If you expect to ferment at high alcohol level, inoculate the wine concurrent with the alcoholic fermentation, a technique that's known as co-inoculation. One of the things you can do to prevent this from occurring is to ensure that your wine's pH, temperature, alcohol, and SO2 are within the malolactic bacteria specifications in the range that they are tolerant, and supplement it with nutrients and or carry out the malolactic fermentation on the nutrient-rich fine lees. Stir the lees very gently to avoid excessive oxygen intake. For more difficult conditions, you can first condition the malolactic fermentation bacteria inoculum using a commercial apple juice. In addition to the alcoholic fermentation yeast, a yeast strain that flavors MLF, and some yeast strains are known to inhibit malolactic bacteria. Next problem we want to talk about is that the color of the wine is too light. Sometimes when you take a look at a wine, it just doesn't quite look as red as much as you'd like for it to look or as deep a color as you'd like for it to be. And sometimes, except for red varietals known as tinturers, which have a red pulp and juice, the pulp and juice can range from a light yellow to a golden yellow color. In reds, color comes from the grape skin, anthocyanins, the color pigments, extracted during maceration fermentation. Some varietals inherently have greater amounts of color than others. It's influenced by viticulture practices and growing conditions. For example, the thicker-skinned Cabernet Sauvignon will have a much deeper color than the thin-skinned, cool-climate-grown Pinot Noir. As a matter of fact, if you go into some parts of Argentina where the altitude is around 8,000, 9,000 feet above sea level and take a look at the Cabernet Sauvignon they're growing there, the skins are extremely thick because the higher elevation allows more ultraviolet radiation to reach the vines and the grapes, causing a much thicker skin and therefore creating a wine that is almost dark as black ink as a result of the much thicker, more dense coloring in the skins. When white wines are left to age too long, they progressively darken to a golden color and then finally to a brownish red. And then ultimately, reds will turn into an orange and then brick red and a brownish color and become lighter as a result of the anthocyanin polymerization. That's a fancy word for something like oxidation, with some other anthocyanins and tannins. It's to be expected that fining and filtering operations will lighten the color, but overfining can excessively strip the color out of your wine. An almost colorless wine may be the result of excessive fining or using an unsuitable fining agent. The same is true for lightly colored reds, although common causes are insufficient color development in grape skins because of a poor vintage or viticulture practices or too short of a maceration. In addition, some grape varieties just naturally have low pigmentation, and no amount of maceration can produce a deeply colored wine. But don't be tempted to alter the color by artificial means. You only disrupt the wine chemistry and destabilize the color and possibly impact the quality of your resulting wine, and you don't want to have that happen. For reds, it's best to use a blend of light wine with a deeper colored one. You may want to keep some highly pigmented tintures, such as Alicante Boucher, on hand expressly for this purpose of increasing the color density on your reds. One of the preventive measures you can take is if you have reduced color extraction from your reds, you can add natural yeast derivative nutrients in conjunction with macerating enzymes before the start of fermentation. Use your sulfite sparingly, as sulfur dioxide can have a bleaching effect on the coloring agents inside the wine. And also, make sure you choose a suitable agent for fining your wine. At this point, folks, we're going to take a little break. We'll be back in just a moment after we have a station break. So hang on, folks. We'll be right back. Today's program is being brought to you by Jan Watson's Rare Plant Juices. Jan is a well-known personality in Western North Carolina, where he has sought out a plethora of native wild plants only found in the mountains of Madison County. He's developed an exotic breeding program that allows him to create an eclectic variety of plants to suit the most discriminating gardeners. Jan has won all kinds of awards from garden clubs all over our western mountains in North Carolina for his unorthodox breeding techniques. Recently, I caught up with Jan near his home in Spring Creek, west of Hot Springs, to discuss his really different fruits he's created from breeding different plants. He was dressed in his usual bib overalls and straw hat with a corncob pipe dangling from his mouth. I asked him about his newest creation. He told me that he was crossing a walnut tree with a porcelain berry vine to make a wallberry bush. Jan claims that the resulting wallberries will have a beautiful iridescent blue color, a soft, thin outer shell to make it easy to peel, and firm enough to juice. Jan opened his fridge and offered me a drink of his onion, a cross between an onion and a carrot. The juice tasted like spicy hot carrot juice. He suggests using it for a starting drink with any dinner where wild turkey or wild boar was served. His fridge had many interesting bottles with handwritten labels on the contents. I scanned through them and asked him what each meant. A bottle of Craig is a juice made from his cross of a cranberry and a fig. The flavor was more pleasing than the mud color of the juice, and I didn't like the cranberry skins he left in the juice. Equally disgusting was the juice from his cherry tree cross with a mushroom he calls a charum. His cross between a Coosa dogwood and a potato yielded a Coosato, the juice of which is a deep red color. The flavor is really disgusting, though. Jan said it is an acquired taste. He said his neighbor, Susie Saxton, had tried it last week and had to immediately run outside to keep from making a mess in his kitchen. He then pulled out some of his buffachoke, a cross of a buffalo berry and an artichoke, and splashed a bit in a mason jar for me to taste. The deep green-purple color put me off a bit, but the flavor was quite pleasant, although I didn't like the consistency. It was really thick, like drinking mud. Jan's last offering for my visit was his dandimato, a cross between dandelions and tomatoes. This one was my favorite. It had a very agreeable flavor of tomato with the astringent aftertaste of dandelion roots. Although I thought it a bit strange that it glowed in the dark, a point that Jan had to make by turning off the lights for a minute while I was drinking his concoction. Jan claims he uses a jar of it as a flashlight when checking on his dogs after dark. Jan has made a limited production of each of his rare plant juice drinks for sale in small pint-sized mason jars with his handwritten personalized labels. You can buy Jan Watson's rare plant juices at the retail counter of Zuma's Cafe in downtown Marshall for $1.298 a jar. Jan Watson's rare plant juices. More great products made in the good old U.S. of A. here in the mountains of Madison County, North Carolina. And now back to our regular program.
Well, welcome back, everybody. At the beginning of this particular show, we've been talking about some of the winemaking problems you may run into. I like to call it my troubleshooting segment, or what the heck happened. I can tell you with some degree of certainty that making wine is a lot of fun, It's also a very, very steep learning curve for those of you who are getting started. In a previous life, when I had a nice wine cellar down in Arizona years ago, I used to make about 18 to 20 carboys of wine each season. I learned a lot of things very quickly by double batching things, that is, taking two batches of Chardonnay or two batches of Pinot Noir, two batches of a particular wine kit, for example, and adding just two different yeasts to the two carboys to see what would happen, using two different fining agents to see what would happen. And from this steep learning curve, selecting the process that worked best for me and for the wines that I was making. This gives you an idea of the kinds of things that you can do if you get seriously into winemaking, and certainly gives you a depth and understanding about the winemaking process and what actually works best on the small batches of 5 to 6 gallons in each carboy. So from that, I wanted to also share with you the fact that sometimes you forget when you're working with different kinds of grapes, some things can really make things go sideways in a hurry. For example, I was used to working with vinifera grapes and Native American grapes until I moved to North Carolina when I started trying to make wine with muscadines and scuppernong grapes. Well, let me tell you, there is really something seriously different about making wine with muscadines and scuppernongs compared to the vinifera. With all the years and hundreds of gallons of wine that I'd made over the years, it was very exciting to find out that I couldn't put my muscadine and scuppernongs in the primary fermenter and let it sit on the skins for something like 10 days to 2 weeks like we do red wines on the red skins. It made some of the most awful wine I can ever imagine tasting. In fact, some of it was so bad I couldn't fix it, couldn't drink it. I had it either line it up to go through a still or put it down the drain. In any case, just so you know, if you're making muscadine wine or scuppernong wine, you do not want to leave that wine on those skins more than about 5 or 6 hours maximum. 4 hours is preferable. Otherwise, you're going to be extracting some pretty nasty components into the wine, and it will not be drinkable, and you will not be able to fix it. So it's quite a contrast from 4 or 5 hours up to 10 days to 2 weeks. So just keep that in mind if you start making wine, that there is quite a difference between the two. The next segment I want to talk about now is wine that starts to turn brown. Typically, this is a symbol of an oxidation problem, but it usually revolves around some special types of enzymes in grapes. And this reaction begins when you crush them and press them, or if they've been damaged in harvest or in transport. This can be somewhat upsetting when the wine juice quickly turns a brownish color. And this is due to the low phenol content in the white varietals. The brown compounds will eventually settle and separate through racking, but browning wine is a result of oxidation due to a reaction with oxygen absorbed during the wine processing activities or aging. Reds are much better protected by virtue of their significantly higher polyphenol content, so there's less incidence of browning that takes place in them. If the browning starts unexpectedly or prematurely, particularly if the wine is in bulk, it points to a serious oxidation problem where ethanol is being oxidized in acetaldehyde with the skin taking on nutty aromas and flavors. That's similar to a sherry wine. Oxidation can be due to defective or improper use of equipment, excessive exposure to air during processing or storage, or inadequate sulfite protection. Browning is very difficult to correct in oxidized wine, and the acetaldehyde smell can only be lessened with sulfite binds to acetaldehyde. Sorry, this tends to be a little bit crazy on the chemistry for folks who are not so inclined to pay attention to this sort of stuff, but if you really want to get into it, you can find some great references on winemaking that goes into great detail to the chemistry. The most important thing is that what you do to the wine to keep it from turning brown is you want to check all of your equipment, especially your fermentation locks, on a regular basis to make sure there's no faults allowing the oxygen to get in. Try to do your best to limit the oxygen intake during post-fermentation operations. Keep all the carboys topped up. Maintain a normal sulfur dioxide level based on the wine pH. Add natural yeast derivative nutrients at the onset of fermentation, and that'll avoid browning from oxidation. You can add some types of antioxidants to low phenol reds, either at the crusher or post-fermentation. Those types of things are sort of what you have to look for when you're really working hard to keep your wine from getting that browning color. The next problem I want to discuss is what happens when the wine smells like vinegar or smells like nail polish. Now, I don't have to tell you, if you get some of that going in your wine, you've got a serious problem that needs to be taken care of. Typically, once the wine's been completely fermented, should be protected from extended exposure to oxygen with adequate sulfur dioxide. Otherwise, harmful bacteria will start feeding on the alcohol and produce acetic acid. Of course, acetic acid is the primary acid in the volatile acidity, the VA that you test, and imparts an unappealing vinegar smell. It can also be further esterified into ethyl acetate, and that'll impart or give an aroma reminiscent of nail polish. Most of the time, this is caused by the result of defective equipment, such as poor seals on the bungs or dry fermentation locks, or poor topping off regimen, your barrels or your carboys. Excessive exposure to air, particularly at a high pH. Wine affected by advanced acetic spoilage can't be cured and is best discarded. I hate to say that, but once you get acetic bacteria working in your wine, you really have to toss it. There's nothing you can do to fix it. It's really too bad. But thinking back over this, once it happens to you, you can prevent this by checking all your equipment, especially your fermentation locks, on a regular basis to make sure there are no faults or gaps where the air can get into your wine. Even better is to discard any moldy grapes that you may have at the crusher, which would otherwise increase your volatile acidity, and add tartaric acid instead of citric acid when acidifying, as the citric acid will be converted to acetic acid during malolactic fermentation. You want to keep your carboys and barrels topped up and maintain a nominal sulfur dioxide level based on wine pH. You want to discard the oak barrels that are affected by this so that you don't have this problem anymore, because you cannot get rid of it once you have it started in there. So the next problem we want to discuss is white film on the wine surface. The problem that causes this is typically the wine is exposed to air, and sometimes it'll develop a film in the surface, and it expand across the surface and take on a whitish green color sometimes. And this is like a rogue yeast. It's a surface yeast that thrive under aerobic conditions. It's most likely caused by defective equipment that's allowed some air to get in and hasn't been adequately topped off, maybe during aging. And this allows the spoilage to begin on the surface, and it works its way down into the volume of wine. The first of all, you have to determine how far down the problems travel. You can use a wine thief and retrieve a sample from just below the surface. Make sure you don't disturb the film. Smell and taste the wine. If it's off, put another sample from lower down and repeat until you're satisfied with the integrity of the sample. Then rank the wine to the point you determine above and discard the remaining wine. Sulfite the wine and process the bottle as soon as possible. If you want to prevent this from happening in the first place, just make sure before you're using any winemaking equipment that you've got good seals and properly functioning equipment. Check all those fermentation locks, specifically looking for any cracked items or areas where might be a way for the air to get in. Be sure to always have water in the lock. For floating lid tanks on the larger batches, test the bladder and the hand pump for leaks and fix or repair any defective parts. This will make sure that you at least have the ability to prevent the white film forming on the surfaces. The next problem I want to discuss is what happens if your wine smells of sulfur. Sulfur dioxide is the most effective preservative for winemaking. The free sulfur dioxide can be easily detected by its distinctive pungent burnt match smell. If detected in wine, it is usually a fault and can actually become overpowering and irritating to the nose at high concentration, and points to overprocessing with sulfite. Yeast produce small amounts of sulfur dioxide during fermentation, but are not enough to drive a level over the detection threshold. If you detect that sulfur smell in fermentation, try aerating your wine again by successive vigorous rackings from one carboy or one barrel to the next. If you detect the sulfur smell in the bottle, aerate the wine by decanting it several times. A good way to prevent this, of course, is to avoid stressing the yeast during fermentation and only add the recommended amount of sulfite based on the wine pH to maintain the desired level of free sulfur dioxide. Typically, you want that around 0.8 milligrams per liter. So that's something that's sort of easy to measure if you have the proper laboratory equipment, but nevertheless, it is something that you can do to prevent the distinctive smell. While we're talking about bacteria and yeast and other things like this, sometimes they're good for the wine, sometimes they're not so good for the wine, I thought it might be beneficial to review just a couple points real quick. When you're measuring specific gravity, you want to be using an instrument called a hydrometer. And you'll typically get numbers of 1.059, 1.103, something like that, when you're reading the specific gravity of a particular wine must or the wine. You can also use something called a refractometer that will give you measurements as percent sugar or something called Brix, B-R-I-X. It's important to know that these two instruments have a good way of telling you when you've gotten to a point in the winemaking process that you don't have to worry about some of the bad actors anymore. As it turns out, about 10.5% potential alcohol, which corresponds to 19 Brix on a refractometer or 1.079 specific gravity on a hydrometer, is the point at which about 99.9% of the bacteria that can cause problems can no longer survive in the higher alcohol content. So most winemakers breathe a sigh of relief whenever they see their wine get up to that 10.5% alcohol measurement. But again, this is something that's easy to detect, something you should be well aware of. So when you're doing your winemaking, you have the opportunity to take into account all of the things that may be happening that could cause some problems for your wine. I'm going to conclude this segment. I'll call this part one of the troubleshooting or what the heck happened when you're winemaking segment. And we'll continue it on part two the next time. Meanwhile, folks, keep on fermenting and stay tuned. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Mountain Grapevine.
This is The Mountain Grapevine on WART Community Radio from Madison County, North Carolina. If you have a friend whom you think might enjoy my program, tell them my Thursday programs will be rebroadcast on Sundays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Chuck Blethyn signing off for today. Cheers!